Okay, so today I'm going to talk to you about advancing health and human rights and what the role is of the health professional in providing forensic medical evaluations for asylum seekers and other victims of human rights abuses that have come to this country. Might be a problem here. Okay, so I have no relationships to disclose. So I'd like to start just very briefly going over a couple of different terms because there's a lot of overlap between some of them, and people ask me, whenever I do talks about this, people ask me to distinguish between them. So an asylum seeker is someone who is in this country. They're seeking protection to be here, but their claim for refugee status hasn't been determined yet. So they're here. They may have come on a student visa, a work visa. They may have come in without papers. They're in this country waiting to go through a tremendous legal process in order to attain asylum, permission to live here. Refugees are people whose legal status has already been confirmed. It's already been settled. They got to have that opportunity in their country of origin. They applied to the government over there, went through the paperwork, the application process. By the time they get here, they have obviously lots of problems and obstacles to overcome, but at least their legal status is settled. And finally, survivors or victims, whatever. These are where, you know, there's overlap between refugees can be survivors or victims. Asylum seekers can be as well. Sometimes we conflate these terms and, you know, within survivors, there may be people, for example, who don't meet this asylum criteria, but they may be able to apply for other kinds of protection in this country. So I wanted to just give you some brief asylum statistics to kind of put this all in context for you. Very interestingly, the number of asylum applications in the country is rising dramatically again. It had been going down in recent years, but this latest statistic is from UNHCR, and already just in the first 6 months this year, we have over 36,000 people applying for asylum. It's very significant. They're coming from more than 100 countries. China's the top sending country. The next countries I've listed there also are sending lots of people here. They're all within the top 10. And very generally, we're seeing historically a 30% denial rate of all asylum applications. That rate varies dramatically among judges, among jurisdictions, things of that nature. But across the board, it's gone up a little bit lately. I think they're saying it's around 33 or 34% in recent years. But historically, it's only about 30%. The people that come to this country and are applying for asylum or are coming, you know, as other victims of human rights abuses are extremely vulnerable populations. I've listed several factors here. You can imagine what they're coming from. Some people may be suffering from all of these different things, different factors that can compromise physical as well as mental health. I think something, you know, I mean, basically you can separate it between the factors that affected them in their country of origin, and then the factors that affected them, you know, things that arose on the journey over here, and then things that may still be affecting them when they're in the country. So, you know, several factors, and they can compound one another and become, you know, everything can worsen over time as the number of negative factors increases. The next problem for many of these people is that they end up in immigration detention. Immigration detention is a huge system. About 400,000 people end up in immigration detention for some period of time over the course of any year. At any given day, there are about 33,000 people held in immigration detention. So, you know, I could talk for hours about that system. But in short, what I want you to understand is that it's a detained for deportation model. So they're in detention, and the assumption that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has is that eventually they're going to be deported. So we don't really want to spend too much resources on taking care of them while they're in detention. They don't have any mandate to maintain or restore health. You know, if you have a heart attack, if you're bleeding on the floor, acute things they're going to deal with, but there's very little attention given to chronic conditions, so things like diabetes, high blood pressure, even HIV, AIDS, things like that. Lots of people are not getting their medication. They're not getting the care that they need. Additionally, there are strong security concerns that ICE has. even though this is meant to be an administrative custody system, in effect, it acts as a penal custody system, and there's a significant lack of transparency and accountability. A lot of NGOs are working with ICE to improve that and to try and get changes in the system, but the lack of transparency is really quite an obstacle that we're always working to overcome. Here you can see this quote, "We protect America by providing health care and public health services in support of immigration enforcement." This is the mandate that they have to care for people in immigration detention. So you can see that, you know, the law enforcement is, you know, the key part of it for them. These are just some different case examples. I won't read through them all, but, you know, just to demonstrate that the breadth of different types of asylum seekers and survivors of human rights abuses that come to this country seeking protection is really significant. People from all over the world, all different kinds of situations they're escaping from. Sometimes they've already undergone, you know, different violations, direct violations. In other cases, maybe they're fearful that they will have to undergo different things. And so they come here to seek protection that we're obligated to give them under the Refugee Convention. So what the main part of, you know, what I'd like to talk to you about today is the opportunity that health professionals have to interact with these people, to work with them and their attorneys in the court process, in the asylum process, to support their applications and to help them receive the protection. As I mentioned, the approval rate is somewhere around 30, maybe at the high end, 35%. But when health professionals become involved in these evaluations, we can see the approval rate increase dramatically. The clinical evaluations, and I'll tell you more about those in a moment, but they're critical pieces of evidence because so many people escape from their countries. They come here under dangerous conditions. They don't have evidence. They don't have, obviously, photographs, videos, things of the persecutors in their country or what they fear or what they or their family members have undergone. But clinical evaluations, the medical legal affidavit that a health professional generates after doing the evaluation, can be a critical piece of evidence, and the judges and the asylum officers really respect that. So, and, you know, statistically, 90% of the cases that our organization arranges to have evaluations for are eventually granted asylum or some other form of protection in this country. This statistic has held true over the past decade. We recently just reran the numbers in recent years, and we're really pleased to see that we're still seeing a very high success rate, you know, just validating the process and what health professionals can bring to it. So the primary purpose of the evaluation, and these evaluations, they can be physical evaluations or they can be psychological evaluations. They don't have to be done by doctors. They can be done by nurses, psychologists, clinical social workers, lots of different people, lots of different health professionals. And they're to establish the facts relating to torture and to, you know, document the consistency of the events, the narrative that the person gives with the physical manifestations they may have, with the psychological manifestations they may have. So to give a very simple example, if someone says, you know, they're telling a story about how they were tortured in their country, and they say, yes, you know, XYZ happened, and I was beaten with some sort of a cane rod, and the evaluator can look at the person's back and see what the scars look like, and can corroborate that, yes, indeed, this is highly consistent with the scars that we would see from a cane rod or something like that. Or they can do psychological evaluations, assessing whether the person has PTSD, how did the person react when they told the narrative, what sort of body language did they have, what did their face look like, maybe when they're telling the story of how they had to of how they were tied up, maybe they actually grab cords and, like, tie them around themselves and demonstrate how it was. These various things that can happen in the course of the clinical evaluation can be really strong, compelling evidence that the health professional can put in an affidavit to document, you know, how the credibility of this person is. Lots of detail here, but, you know, these are the different components of what the clinical evaluation is. I'm very short. You do, it's not very short, but in short, to explain it, you do a comprehensive interview of the person to hear about their story, to see how they tell the story. You're going to look for acute and chronic illnesses and injuries. You document, written and with photographs, and I know some people feel uncomfortable asking to photograph, but photographs are so compelling in the courtroom. It's cliche to say a picture is worth a thousand words, but in the courtroom it really is true. The evaluator will also talk about, the consistency between what they're seeing physically or mentally and what the person's story is. Do these things seem to match up? Does the person seem to be telling the truth? And in the end, they'll render their expert opinions. They'll put it in a medical legal affidavit, which is basically a report that they swear to the truth to. And in many cases, they might be called to testify to the court as well. There are obviously, lots of challenges to doing this kind of work. And what I'm describing to you is strictly a volunteer enterprise. All the physicians who do it with us are volunteering their time. And so there are many challenges. Obviously, there are language and cultural barriers. We're talking about people from all around the world, so you may speak a foreign language, but probably no one speaks over 100 foreign languages. The time constraints, everyone's super busy, of course. Sometimes we have limited access to the victim. The person may be in immigration detention. That makes doing the evaluations that much harder. It's often hard to get health records. They probably didn't bring them with them from their country of origin. You may have limited access to their health records from detention. Of course, it's emotionally very difficult, and our health professionals have to be aware of the potential for secondary trauma and hearing these stories all the time. I'm an immigration attorney myself who does pro bono work, and it can be heartbreaking to hear the stories. So you have to be aware of that. It's very emotionally charged. Some of our health professionals may lack the confidence to start out to write a medical legal affidavit and or particularly to testify in court. It can be very intimidating, so that's something that we work with people on. And also, the challenge of working with attorneys. I didn't know until recent years that there's this, this sort of angst sometimes between health professionals and attorneys. And so obviously working with attorneys is challenging as well, but I think it's a great opportunity for attorneys and doctors to work together on the same team without worrying about malpractice. So the benefits of asylum are significant. I can't say enough. It's security. They are in this country. They don't have to worry about being deported, eligible for temporary government support. They can bring eligible immediate family members to this country. They get work authorization, new opportunities to rebuild their lives, to make money, to resettle, to see doctors, to get over the trauma, and to feel like their story was finally validated by someone in this country saying, yes, that was persecution, that's unacceptable, and we're going to protect you now. It's really tremendous. I have a few success stories here that I won't spend any time on, in fact. we should keep moving. But there are many of them, and it's really thrilling to hear about the different people, and especially when we hear that, wow, they got a job now and they were able to bring their family here, and it's really an amazing work to be part of. So finally, to tell you about PHR, Physicians for Human Rights Enterprise, is we have the Asylum Network, and that's the group that I'm directing. It's a group of about almost 500 health professionals across the country. I think we have people in about 32 states right now. And we do about 500 evaluations a year for people. About 60% of them are psychological, the balance are physical evaluations, and they're pro bono. The doctors get this great chance to work with people to really feel, not to feel like they are, but in fact to actually make difference in these lives. And if you think about, about 500 cases a year, a 90% success rate, that's a lot of lives saved in the course of the year. So it's very compelling. And if anyone is interested in this work, I encourage you to please talk to me after this. I put a few brochures on the back table in case anyone's interested, and we would welcome health professionals, any kind of health professionals, to work with us. Thank you.